Well, thank you very much for coming this evening. My name is Jennifer Jackson-Preece. I'm Deputy Head of the European Institute here at the London School of Economics, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you tonight to a, which I'm sure will be a fascinating conversation with our two speakers. We are joined, of course, today by Stephen Wall, who I'm sure, as many of you will already know, has a very distinguished track record within the British diplomatic service. He has worked closely with five British prime ministers, including Prime Minister John Major, and he has also served, of course, among other things, as the permanent representative to the European Union on behalf of the UK. His book on Britain's EU policy, A Stranger in Europe, was published in 2008, and he has also written The Official History of Britain and the European Community, 1963-1975, which was published in 2012. We're also joined by my colleague from the International History Department, Piers Ludlow, who I'm sure many of you will also know. Piers teaches regularly on European integration here at LSE in the history of European integration, and I'm sure he will be an excellent interlocutor. We are running a hashtag tonight for those of you who would like to share the experience via Twitter. The appropriate hashtag is hashtag LSE Brexit, and I know that they are always keen to get as much of a social media conversation as well as a real conversation, yet another way of sharing what's happening at the school with those that could not be here today. I should, in final point, say you are lucky to have a seat. I'm told they were turning people away. So we are now incumbent upon ourselves to have a really excellent conversation. Yeah. It will be podcast, and if you do have colleagues who wish to be here but could not, then please do remind them that the event will be podcast, and it will be available from the LSE website after it has concluded. So for now, please, Stephen.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for being here, and thanks to LSE for the invitation. The title I've been given is Britain, Brexit, and the EU. Was this a love affair gone wrong, or always an unhappy marriage of convenience? I'm going to start with a few comments about us from three of our continental neighbours. The first comment is a French comment about us, describing this country as composed of people who are affable to no other nation than their own. Second comment is a German comment that we think ourselves, we the British think ourselves the wisest people in the world, and that the world does not exist apart from us. And the third quote is from an Italian, that we are great lovers of ourselves and of everything belonging to us. So the first of those quotes is from Jean Froissart in the 14th century. The second of those quotes is from a German visitor to England in the 15th century. And the third quote is from a Venetian traveler to England in the 16th century. So you can see that maybe nothing changes. Back in the day when I worked for Tony Blair, we went to a meeting of the European Council, the European Summit, in Seville. And it was, the European Union was then composed of 15 countries, and we met in what was basically a large exhibition center with kind of partitions put up to make the different delegation offices. And I can't remember whether it was World Cup or World Cup qualifiers, but anyway, England were playing at the start of the day, and so the beginning of the meeting was deferred so that everybody could watch the game that England was involved in. And when the final whistle blew and England had been defeated, around the 14 other delegation rooms, you could hear a great cheer go up. And Tony Blair turned to us and said, "They don't like us much, do they?" Well, the roots of this issue are undoubtedly rooted in geography. Not that we were never invaded. The Romans, the Saxons, the Vikings, the Normans, even the Dutch, sailing up the Thames in the time of Samuel Pepys in the 17th century, bear witness to that. But conquest has been relatively rare in the British-English history. And of course, the psychology of a land frontier versus a sea frontier, they are very different things. If you have a sea frontier, and obviously I'm talking about a period before the advent of aviation or the tunnel, if you have a sea frontier, you have to make more of an effort in both directions. The sea, to an extent, protects you. You have to make an effort to get there. It took Julius Caesar 2 goes before he could get his ships safely to the English coast, and it wasn't actually until the Emperor Claudius 50 years later that the Roman conquest was completed. William the Conqueror in 1066 took 2 goes to get to successfully to land on our shores. The Spanish Armada in the 16th century never got there because the ships were broken up in a storm on the cliffs of Ireland and Scotland. Winston Churchill, in one of his most famous wartime broadcasts to the people of the continent of Europe, said, "We are waiting for the long-promised invasion, so are the fishes." And of course, if you set sail from an island, if you set sail from this island, well, you may go only to Calais, but you may also, or instead, go as far as China. Now, of course, I'm not trying to paint a simplistic portrait of Britain. We are, like most other nations, even before our own century, composed of people of multifarious origins. The landscape of England is littered with Saxon, Nordic, and Norman names, and many of our place names, such as Nottingham or Durham, reflect the fact that their former names were unpronounceable to Norman overlords. Because of the Norman conquest, and because of claims that Duke William and his successors had on territory in France, England and France became mixed up in each other's affairs, largely through war, in ways which did not really end until the fields of Waterloo a little over 2 centuries ago. Indeed, anyone who experienced the British negotiation to join the EEC might say that just as war is diplomacy by other means, so as far as Britain and France were concerned, diplomacy was war by other means. Anyway, for 3 centuries after the Norman conquest, French was the language of the court. Richard the Lionheart, one of our supposed national heroes, was born in France, died in France, spoke no English, and ransacked the country of which he was king, both literally and financially. So the story is really a fourfold one. First of all, an ongoing struggle between barons and the king for control over resources, because the king, successive kings, did basically regard the land and the people in it as to be exploited. A struggle for control of which Magna Carta and Simon de Montfort's Parliament are examples. Wars in France in which English kings, thinking themselves as much French as English, struggled for territory and control. An arm lock between the 2 great pillars of the state, the crown on the one hand and the church on the other, and we're talking about the Christian church being the Catholic Church in pre-Reformation times, and then also the gradual evolution, even through periods of massive turbulence, of English common law, brilliantly summed up in one of Lord Denning's famous judgments in 1964, when he said the following. "The poorest man," he said, "may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. His cottage may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter. All his force dares not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement unless he has justification by law." I mentioned the struggle between crown and the church, and that does bring us to the Reformation. And among others, to Thomas More, who was executed by Henry VIII, and who is a very good example of England at the time as being a Renaissance country, as were many of those on the continent. More and the Dutchman Erasmus were friends and colleagues. More's book, Utopia, was printed and well-known all over Europe. And for Thomas More, his argument against the king was not just about Henry's divorce and marriage and Henry's usurpation of control of the church in England, but the fact that More, the civil servant, the lawyer, believed that the basic relationship between church and state was fundamental to the stability of society, and that Henry, in the action that he was taking, was basically disrupting the basic stability on which society rested. But Henry VIII too was the quintessential Renaissance man. who spoke Latin and Greek and both sang and composed music. And it was not so much a sense of Englishness that motivated Henry when it came to the Reformation, but rather that Englishness was a readily available tool for a skilled and ruthless manipulator to deploy to support both his personal behavior, his divorce and the marriage to Anne Boleyn, and on an attack on the fabric of the church in England, which would otherwise have been far, and indeed was, far from unopposed. And Henry would have gone on considering himself a Catholic when he became head of the church in England, so far as the law of God allows, a phrase of which any of today's commissioned lawyers would have been proud if they'd invented it. Mass continued much as before. Extant missals from that time show only one change in the Mass, and that is that in each one that survives, in pencil, the prayers for the Pope have been erased. So what started with Henry, that sense of Englishness in defiance of the Pope, not just as a religious leader, but as a temporal leader, was compounded by his daughter, Queen Mary, who married a Spaniard and tried by extreme force to reconvert England to Catholicism. It was further compounded by Elizabeth I, her successor, her successful repulsion of the Spanish Armada, with not a little help from the wind and the tide and a rocky foreshore, and her more pragmatic attitude to the practice of religion, and the fact that faced with an invasion from Spain, blessed by the Pope, Catholics who otherwise might have been opposed to Elizabeth put their Englishness and their loyalty to the crown ahead of their loyalty to their faith. And there came to be in England a long-standing and deep-rooted belief in Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, as being the representation of an aggressive foreign power. I ask for forgiveness for those who've heard me tell this story before, but it is quite illustrative. In 1931, my father, who was a Methodist, brought up in Derbyshire, got engaged to my mother, who was a Roman Catholic. My father's family had come over as foot soldiers with the Norman Conquest and were what were known as yeoman farmers. In other words, small-scale farmers owning their own land, raising sheep and pigs and selling them at a butcher's shop in Buxton in Derbyshire. And the Catholic Church required that any non-Catholic marrying a Catholic should give a written undertaking that the children of the marriage would be brought up as Catholics. And my great aunt, my father's aunt, also living in Derbyshire, wrote him a letter which said the following. "Do not forget," she said, "that in the churchyard in Darleydale, in Derbyshire, lie the remains of generations of members of the war family, yeoman stock, the breath and backbone of England, and do not put your children under the yoke of popery." Now, this isn't 1631, this is 1931. And my aunt wasn't talking about the doctrine of transubstantiation or the Immaculate Conception. She was talking about her image of the Pope as the representative of an alien foreign power. And growing up as a Catholic in the 1950s, even then I was aware of that tendency continuing. Talked about the battle between the barons and then subsequently an evolving parliament versus the monarch, in particular over the power to raise money. Comes to its head in the English Civil War, where parliament cut off the head of the king to assert its rights over taxation. When I was British ambassador to the EU in Brussels, the issue of tax harmonization within the European Union was very current, and there was a move to move from the requirement of unanimity towards majority voting. And at that stage, we were the only member state opposed. And I used to say to my colleagues in the Committee of Permanent Representatives, which discussed this thing, you know, don't forget that in England we cut the head off the king to assert Parliament's rights over taxation. And this is deeply embedded in our politics and our psychology. And I think you could argue that with the execution and death of Charles I, you get to a situation where no English monarch since has ruled except by the tacit consent of the people. You also get an early example of British pragmatism. Just as Manchester United may contain very few players of English origin, let alone Mancunian origin, so in succession, when Parliament got rid of James II, Charles II's successor, because of his attempts to reconvert England to Catholicism, his successor was William of Orange, and we then had the Hanoverians, we then had the Saxe-Coburgs, as late as King George V. If you listen to his Christmas broadcast from the 1920s and 30s, you can hear the trace of a German accent. Last week, the Times carried a cartoon related to the fate of EU citizens in this country, and it shows the Queen and Prince Philip over the breakfast table, and she's saying to Philip, "Gott in Himmel, Philip, they're going to throw us out because we are Europeans." So you have that evolution. And then, of course, on the back of particularly war between France and England, a war carried out across continents, Canada and India in particular, you have the evolution of the British Empire and the Pax Britannica that dominated the 19th century. And then in the last century, two world wars, which in Britain's case reinforced our sense of strong national identity. And here you come back again to the importance of frontiers. For the countries of continental Europe emerging from World War II, the one thing that was perhaps most apparent to them was that those countries that had been invaded and conquered and had suffered appallingly, that their frontiers were completely porous. So for them, if they were looking for security in the future, the frontier was not the place where they would look to find it or create it. Whereas for the British, the psychology, because we hadn't been invaded by Hitler, was very different. And so for those who were in at the beginning, the six countries who formed the European community in the 1950s, part of their motivation was creating a supranational structure in which the bad aspects of nationality would be contained. But as Alan Millwood in his first volume of the official history pointed out, paradoxically, that same action, of course, made the nation state respectable again, because it did create a framework in which the nation state could thrive, because there were rules which contained it. And so you get a situation in the 1980s when Helmut Kohl was Chancellor of Germany, where he could espouse and eventually bring about German reunification, because he was doing so within the context of European Union. It's one of the reasons why he espoused closer European Union, within a context of European Union that would not be threatening, seem to be threatening to France's neighbours. There were other reasons why we, the British, stayed out. We had, after all, won the war. We'd established a close relationship with the United States. Most of our trade was not with continental Europe, but with the countries of the so-called Old Commonwealth. In 1955, for example, Britain's largest export market was a country of then 10 million people, namely Australia. So it's not surprising that in that same year, the then permanent undersecretary at the Treasury, Sir Edward Bridges, grandfather of the Lord Bridges, who now is the minister for Brexit in the House of Lords, that Sir Edward Bridges should write to the then Chancellor of the Exchequer as follows: "The government should not be led astray." This is while our partners on future partners were devising what became the Treaty of Rome. "The government should not be led astray by the kind of mysticism which appeals to European Catholic Federalists and occasionally, I fear, to our Foreign Secretary." The Foreign Secretary in question was Harold Macmillan. And within a few months, Harold Macmillan had moved from the Foreign Office to the Treasury, and the boot was on the other foot. Macmillan was writing to his permanent secretary, Sir Edward Bridges, as follows: "What are we to do? Are we just to sit back and hope for the best? If we do that, it may be very dangerous for us. For perhaps Messina," the conference that gave rise to the Treaty of Rome, "for perhaps Messina will come off after all, and that will mean Western Europe dominated in fact by Germany and used as an instrument for the revival of power through economic means. It is really giving them on a plate what we fought two world wars to prevent." So first of all, Macmillan and then Harold Wilson, his Labour successor, they looked at alternatives. They created a European free trade area to rival the common market, but it wasn't big enough or powerful enough to do so. They looked at a North Atlantic free trade area, but the Americans basically said, look, we've fought two world wars on behalf of you guys. We want you to be part of the emerging Europe. And they looked at what they called GITA, Go It Alone, and Macmillan concluded, and he wrote a pamphlet to the British people saying so, that in a world dominated by two superpowers, namely the United States and the Soviet Union, going it alone was simply not an option for Britain. So for Macmillan, and then for Harold Wilson, membership of the European Economic Community was partly an economic issue, but it was above all political one. But it was very controversial. Macmillan had huge difficulty persuading his cabinet to go for negotiations. At the end of 1962, Ian MacLeod, who was the chairman of the Conservative Party, put in a paper to the cabinet saying, this project is becoming deeply unpopular with the public and with members of our own party, and we're going to have to mount a massive public relations exercise. Well, a little over a month later, President de Gaulle of France vetoed the British application, and that was the end of the story for the time being. And Harold Wilson had similar difficulties within his own party, within his own cabinet, and of course again, in 1967, faced a second veto from de Gaulle. So although we were late to the party, there were 10 years in which we were kept out against our will, and for those of us who remember it, I was 16 in 1963, it was a deeply humiliating moment for Britain, even though de Gaulle had perfectly good reasons of French national interest for the decisions that he took. So when Macmillan, after de Gaulle had lost power, when Wilson, after de Gaulle had lost power, prepared to try again, and when Heath, who defeated Wilson in a general election in 1970, actually picked up the baton to complete the negotiations, they were faced with an unpalatable fact, that here was an organization which existed. De Gaulle's successor, President Pompidou, was persuaded by the German Chancellor, Willy Brandt, to open the door to negotiations, but only on condition that the terms of the budget of the European Community would be decided before negotiations opened with Britain. And those terms were such that in what was to be an enlarged European Community of 9 countries, only Britain and Germany would be net contributors to the budget as opposed to net beneficiaries from it. And Germany was by far and away the most prosperous country of the European Community, and Britain in relative terms was one of the poorer ones. So the Heath government had to decide, do we back away or do we go ahead? And they decided to go ahead on the basis that membership was too important, both politically and economically, for Britain, for us to withdraw, because we'd only have to apply again and perhaps get even worse terms. So basically, Britain joined in the knowledge that it would have to renegotiate, effectively, an important aspect of our membership from within. But meanwhile, of course, the issue had become even more controversial in the Labour Party in opposition, and Harold Wilson, in order to keep his party together, was obliged to promise that if Labour were returned to power, they would both renegotiate and hold a referendum on whether Britain should stay in the European community. And that referendum was won, as we know, I'll come on to that, but it shows that in both main political parties during all that period, there was real division. And those divisions persisted. Just as an example, in 1982, when the British government tried to cast a veto under an obscure procedure known as the Luxembourg Compromise, where even where majority voting applied, a member state could invoke an important national interest to prevent a vote, nonetheless, the vote went ahead and Britain was voted down. It's the first time this had happened. And Margaret Thatcher's reaction was one of fury because, she said, this will reopen the whole question of British membership within the Conservative Party. Later on, after she'd lost office, sitting on the back benches in the House of Lords, Margaret Thatcher set herself up in opposition to the Maastricht Treaty, negotiated by John Major, the treaty that brought in the single currency, but from which Britain had an opt-out. So within the Conservative Party, loyalty to the fallen leader, as it were, became synonymous with hostility to Europe. And one of the young acolytes who sat at her feet at that time was David Cameron. When I worked for John Major in the early 1990s, I can remember on one or other European issue saying to him, why don't you do this, that, or the other? And he said to me, because I am standing astride a crack in the Conservative Party that's getting wider by the minute. Even Tony Blair, incoming Labour Prime Minister in 1997, was faced with the difficulty of public opinion not being absolutely on side in terms of British membership. And when Tony Blair very reluctantly in 2004 conceded that there would be a referendum on what was then a proposed European constitutional treaty, he did so not because he believed in referendums, he very clearly didn't, but because he knew that he would, if he didn't offer a referendum, he would lose the support of the Murdoch press, and indeed that Rupert Murdoch was threatening to campaign for Gordon Brown to take over from him as leader of the Labour Party and Prime Minister. So that tension between heart and head was ever present. As I mentioned, in 1975, the British people voted by a large majority, 66%, to stay in the European Community. But we faced at the time what seemed to us a very real threat from the Soviet Union, and there was the issue of safety in numbers. And frankly, compared with our continental partners, the UK economy was a basket case. And Parliament and the British people, I think, could accept the implications of the Treaty of Rome, i.e. a dynamic treaty in which whenever law at European level is passed, that law has to be accepted, obviously, by all the nation states. You cannot have 9 countries, then 12, 15, now 27 months we've gone, agreeing something, and then each national parliament deciding we'll implement this bit and not the other. But this wasn't a one-time thing, A, because the treaty is dynamic in the way I've described, but also, of course, because we had, in the mid-1980s, the Single European Act, and then the Maastricht Treaty, the Amsterdam Treaty, the Nice Treaty, the Constitutional Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty. So the British Parliament was constantly being confronted, if you like, by the fact that its sovereignty was subject to these very, if you like, severe constraints on the exercise of national sovereignty in its purest sense. If you look at opinion polls across the period we're talking about, apart from the time of the referendum, I can only remember one time, and that is in the mid-1980s, when British public opinion, in terms of it being favorable to the European community, rose to levels equivalent to those in 75, and that was in the mid-1980s when Margaret Thatcher negotiated the so-called Single European Act, which opened the way to the common market, the single market as we know it. And in order to raise awareness of the single market among British business, Lord Young, who was then the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, mounted a 3-month television campaign, a campaign of television commercials promoting the single market. And awareness of the single market went from 3% at the beginning of the campaign to 99% at the end of it. And along with that, public support for the European project rose to 66%. But apart from that, if you look at opinion polls over the period, you've got a thing like that, i.e. sometimes staying in is just ahead, sometimes leaving is just ahead. Now, none of this tension between the heart and the head means that we, the British, did not make a significant contribution to the future success of the project. When we joined, the Common Agricultural Policy represented 75% of the European budget, even though it represented even then a relatively minuscule proportion of Europe-wide GDP. The reform of the Common Agricultural Policy was very much a British objective and a relative success. The single market wouldn't have happened when it happened without Margaret Thatcher. The first person to propose binding treaty rules on common foreign policy was Margaret Thatcher. And she and her successors, in particular John Major and Tony Blair, were champions of future enlargement to Eastern and Central Europe. But governments, because it was a controversial issue, ducked selling the project publicly. And of course, our own evolution has been accompanied by the evolution that we've all seen on the continent. A change which Luc van Middelaar, who worked for the President of the European Council and is now an academic at Louvain University, a change that Luc has argued is about an organisation, the European Union, that has had to adapt from being simply an organisation of rules to being an organisation of action, managing a single currency, managing migration, managing a refugee crisis, for which perhaps it's ill adapted. Now, I doubt whether David Cameron, when he launched the referendum to stave off the threat to his party from UKIP, felt the hand of history on his shoulder. In any case, you can't throw the dice of a country's destiny as casually and carelessly as he did and then expect to be taken at your word when you turn round and say that the game is, after all, one of life and death. In the campaign, there were exaggerations on both sides, but it seems to me that prominent Brexiteers now in government have exchanged the mendacious hyperbole of their campaign statements for a dishonest optimism which passes for a serious conversation with us, the electorate. A prominent EU ambassador here in London said to me the other day that Britain's partner governments cannot decipher what is our government's policy between the threats, the bombast and the braggadocio on the one hand, and the pleas for a deal which will not inflict damage on our economy on the other. I hope that the Prime Minister's statement that no deal would be better than a bad deal was made before the extent of our intertwined relationship with the rest of the EU had become apparent to her, be it in trade, aid, foreign and security policy, energy interdependence, travel, the right to work, rights of residence, airline agreements, mobile telephone charges. I could go on. But one thing above all, I hope I've illustrated that the fate of our nation has, since the dawn of our history, been inextricably intertwined with that of our continental neighbours. More of British history has been played out in bloodshed on the continent than in our own country. We belatedly joined, but we did shape a uniquely successful set of institutions which have helped keep the peace and spread policies and values which are ones we cherish and I believe should continue to cherish. Now, I plead guilty to being an elitist, public school, Oxbridge-educated, expert member of the so-called establishment. But I'm not prepared to be cowed into pretending that what we have done in the Brexit vote is not perilous to our own interests and that of our neighbours and allies and to our collective stability and security. The fact that the EU is in difficulties doesn't negate, in my view, the validity of the underlying model. And it does reinforce the case for conducting the forthcoming negotiations thoughtfully, carefully, responsibly, and with a sense of all that is at stake for us and others. Now, of course, the government has to respect the referendum result. Unless there's a change of heart by the British people, we can't reverse the referendum decision. But we do have a right, it seems to me, to expect of our government maturity, vision, and a sense that Britain, as one of the big European powers, has a continuing duty to work with France, Germany, and others for our common peace and prosperity. Prominent on the London Underground at the moment is a poster of Churchill and the famous quote from his address to Parliament and the British people in 1940, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." He trusted the people. He told my parents, maybe some of your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, truthfully what to expect. Today, I have the impression that the government want to gloss over the tough and even dangerous reality of Brexit and coast to an election victory in 2020 before the pain hits home. If that is the tactic, it may work. But would it not be more honourable for our Prime Minister, maybe it's now too late, but to have acknowledged that she was a very senior member of the government that called the referendum and then argued the case for remaining in the EU, both for its positive contribution to our peace, stability, and prosperity, and for the risks we would incur if we left. Those arguments, she might have said, were soundly based, but a majority of the British people, having heard the arguments, voted to leave. And she could then have said, it is therefore the government's duty to implement that decision, but that it would be dishonest to pretend that the risks to our economic growth and to our wider interests and those of our neighbours, partners, and allies had gone away. So now, she might say, we have to brace ourselves for a difficult negotiation in which we will strive to secure the best outcome we can for our country, even as we prepare for the very different set of new challenges which leaving the EU will bring. So, she might have also said, the government are not asking anybody to change their minds about the decision they took, but to prepare for the fact that we have to find a new basis for the way we conduct our affairs, one that will involve some painful dismantling of long-standing and complex economic and political relationships, one that would require a real effort of imagination, inventiveness, and sheer hard work to safeguard our own prosperity, one that requires patience, creativity, and compromise so as not to destroy what has been built between Britain and the rest of the EU, which was and remains precious, or should remain precious to us and our partners. Now, occasionally, the government say some of these things, but the messages are inconsistent. We want to have as much of the existing trade relationship as possible. But we say, if you're not nice to us, then we'll be the new Singapore and steal your business. We say we will have no truck with the European Court of Justice, even though there will have to be some mechanisms between us and our partners for dispute resolution. Lots of new trade deals are just waiting to happen, we are told, including with the United States, whose president has vowed and keeps vowing to put America first. On the eve of the most momentous and risky negotiation for our country that we have conducted in half a century, we witnessed a week or so ago our foreign secretary telling a former Conservative Prime Minister, John Major, come off it, sunshine, for warning the government about the risks of their offensive rhetoric and for defending, as John Major did, the right of free speech of those who believe that Brexit will be damaging. Boris Johnson, on the other hand, promises that the results of Brexit will be fantastic. Now, it's as if it's all a game, but it is no game. It is, above all, the future of the generation who voted not to leave, but to remain, and who will pay the price of the Foreign Secretary's careless insouciance and of the government's imperfect competence. Now, I have no doubt that the Prime Minister is all too aware of her responsibility for the future of her country. Whether she and her government have the foresight, judgment, and skill to deliver on that responsibility has yet to be demonstrated, even as it is about to be put severely to the test.
I have to confess, I've been looking forward to this ever since I saw the summary referencing Henry VIII. And isn't it wonderful to hear something a little other than Article 50 and our usual shortlist of starring candidates? So that was terrific. Piers, please, when you're ready.
Well, I've done this as a discussant ought to, but many discussants don't. Namely, I came with a totally blank sheet of paper, and I'm going to try and respond to some of the many fascinating ideas and assertions that that Stephen has made in his talk. Let me start off by saying that I entirely agree with the end notes, both in terms of the sort of historical judgment that Britain has always been and, come what may, will remain a major part of European history, and there's no escaping from that, but also some of the comments made at the very end about the difficult predicament the current government finds itself in. But I'm a historian, so I don't do the present and the future, I do the past. So let me go to the past, although I should also add that academic historians now are boringly narrow in our chronological remit, and I kind of listened with a mixture of envy and but also sort of vertigo as Stephen sort of made his references to the Romans and to Henry VIII and to many other periods in between. I will touch upon a little bit of that, but I'm no expert on Roman history or on the Reformation or anything else, so there will be a definite 20th century and probably post-1945 bias to what I have to say. But let me start off by asking one of, I think, the big questions that comes out of what Stephen had to say in his talk, namely the issue about how much does the long-term historical legacy matter? In a way, it was sort of this is kind of partly a question to Stephen himself, because I wasn't quite certain sort of what your ultimate take on it was. Clearly, you can tell a tale, and Stephen did so in quite a lot of his talk, about British exceptionalism about Britain's path being very distinctive, very different, very diverse from that of its European neighbours. I think you could also tell a tale which identifies certain clear-cut points of fracture or of tension that may or may not have played a role in taking us to where we currently are. And you touched upon, I think, some important ones if you are going to take this lingerie approach. One of it is the relative freedom from invasion, although I was glad to hear 1688 mentioned. It always gets forgotten as an invasion, but it is, to all intents and purposes, one. The 1066 myth is a little bit deficient. But it is certainly different. It's certainly true that a sea frontier and a land frontier have had different implications. I think you can also make arguments about the distinctive approach the British have to parliamentary sovereignty, and I'll come back to that issue in a moment. I think you can certainly point to the importance of the Reformation and the Catholic-Protestant split, and I entirely echo some of your points made about a suspicion of Catholicism. One of the weirder contributions, one of the weirder articles in the fantastic collection that the LSE Library has put together of items from the 1975 referendum. There's also a collection being put together of items from the 2016 one, but let's stick with 1975, were some sort of very bizarre Northern Irish pamphlets and posters all about how the suspicious Treaty of Rome, after all, was clearly a Catholic plot to take over Europe and to suppress Protestantism. So there is something there, and I don't want to knock it entirely. Likewise, the very different tradition of common law and the fact that the British did not have the sort of unifying or standardising effects of the Code de Napoleon and so on. So I think you can point to a whole series of quite real things there. But I do find myself wondering how much in the end this matters. Most countries feel pretty exceptional. Ask a Dutchman what makes his country, or a Dutch woman, what makes his or her country distinct. Ask an Italian, ask a Frenchman, ask a German. You're going to get a lot of different points plucked out from their very different and unique understandings of their national history, points that the professional historian might well choose to squabble with or query, but nevertheless amount to a story that is in some ways distinct and distinctive. Now, is the British version of that, what sometimes is referred to as the sort of the island story, inherently so unique and so different from everybody else's tale of exceptionalism that somehow explains why we uniquely have been a difficult member of the EU, and I'll come back to the whole awkward partner issue in a moment, and have ultimately voted to leave it. I find myself struggling with that issue. I'm not necessarily dismissing the long durée history, and I'll come back to it. I think it does matter. But at one level, I do find myself very uncomfortable with the idea that there's a kind of inevitability, that we were kind of programmed by the history of the last 2,000 years to somehow be on a different course and to somehow not be able to stay inside the EU. I find that rather harder to deal with. I also find some of the shorter term historical legacy issues that Stephen raised in his talk difficult. The idea that the Second World War is a fundamentally different, a fundamental break between Britain and its current partners, but soon to be ex-partners, is a long-standing one, and is one that has often been referred to by commentators, both pro-European and anti-European. And clearly the experience, the British experience of World War II was fundamentally different from that of many of the European countries, most of whom tasted defeat in one form or another, whether in 1940 or in 1945. And clearly that does have an impact. But again, I find myself struggling to translate that into the outcome in 2016, I can use that, and I do use that when I teach about this kind of subject, to explain the divergent paths in the 1950s. But I do find myself worrying. Perhaps I instinctively dislike the idea of so much historical determinism, the idea that 60, 70 years on, we are still, in a sense, pre-programmed, predestined by that history to take a divergent path. And I also find myself struggling with the idea that the bumpy start that the British undoubtedly had once they belatedly decided they wanted to join the European project was too fundamental a project. There is something there. It is certainly the case that the 1960s and the period where the British knocked at the community door only to be twice rebuffed by de Gaulle were humiliating, embarrassing, and awkward. It is also the case, of course, that Britain, not being there during that crucial formative period, lost an opportunity to, as to use a metaphor that Roy Jenkins, one of the more outspoken British pro-Europeans, once used, was not at the tailor's while the cloth of suit was cut. While the suit was cut, and therefore it always fitted badly thereafter. And I think there is still something in that argument. And I think you can point to specific policy areas. The CAP was mentioned. The budget was mentioned. I think you could add the common fisheries policy to that, and so on. There are a series of policies that were shaped prior to Britain's arrival that made Britain's arrival difficult. I think you can also take something from the bumpy ride that the British had during their early years of British membership. Again, I'm slightly loath to say that the British have been entirely unique in this, in that there have been other countries that have had difficult rides from within. It bears remembering, of course, that the original bad boy of the European community was not the British, it was the French. And de Gaulle was, in a sense, the model of the awkward European in the 1960s. But the Greeks have also had their problems, occasionally the Danes also, and so on. So I think there are perhaps differences in degree, but I again slightly recoil from making that the key determinant factor. But it is undoubtedly the case that the renegotiation, almost as soon as the British had taken their part, and the referendum campaign, although seemingly decisive in 1975, took their toll on Britain's position, as did the innumerable rows between Britain and her partners that have punctuated the 30, 40 years before. So I think you can make an argument that the British have been a persistently awkward partner, but I still find myself wondering whether that leads to 2016 in a very linear fashion. Having said that, I do think the past or the longer past matters. And I do think it matters not so much because of its reality. That's, in a sense, something for historians to debate about, something for my colleagues and myself to argue about in the privacy of university common rooms and in books that nobody reads. But I think it matters because it forms a reservoir of ideas and notions and, in a sense, emotional ideas that could be and were picked upon and played on by the Eurosceptic criticism from the EU, which goes right back to the beginning, and were extensively exploited and played upon during the referendum campaign themselves. I don't think you can understand a lot of the language in which the Eurosceptic critique of the EU in general, but of British membership in particular, without referring back to some of this historical lingerie. Parliamentary sovereignty is the most obvious example of that, but some of the other ideas were there in the margins and not necessarily totally in the margins. So I do think the long history gave British Europeanism a vulnerability that was ultimately exploited. It was not a vulnerability that necessarily meant that the British were headed for the exit door as soon as they had entered. So it could, in a sense, it did endure for 40 years, it could have endured for 40 more, and why not 40 after that? But there was a vulnerability there. It was like a sort of an internal heart defect that many people will probably live their whole lives and live to 85 with a slightly dicky heart, but there are others who will collapse because of that, because they exert themselves a little bit too much. So it was kind of a weakness that need not necessarily have been decisive, but was. And I think that does connect to the longer term history. Let me briefly refer to a talk that I went to many years ago when I was a student at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, where a senior Spanish, well, actually it was Catalan, I better be careful, minister gave a talk to St. Anthony's about Britain and Spain's paths to Europe. And he made what I thought was a very telling point about the issue of historical legacy. He said, for us Spaniards, and I think he did refer to himself as a Spaniard despite being a Catalan, for us Spaniards, joining Europe in 1986, and of course the Spanish too were even later to the party than were the British, for us Spaniards, joining the European community in 1986 was in a sense reconnecting with a European mainstream from which we felt we had been excluded for 200 to 300 years, and it was reconnecting with the greatest part of our national history, the period of Philip II, etc., when Spain was a European superpower. So for us it was kind of reconnecting with the glory days, and therefore it was much harder to criticise. Whereas for you, the British, it was portrayed, at least, again, historians could quibble about whether this was actual historical reality, if such a thing exists, but nevertheless, for the British, it was portrayed as a sort of somewhat resentful foot, demure decision as Britain accepted its inevitable decline from the glories of the 19th century splendid isolation and the first part of the 20th century when it had been aloof from Europe. So in other words, for the British, it was accepting second or third best, whereas for the Spanish, it was reconnecting with what had been their best. And that respective positive and negative spin, I think, has influenced public opinion in both countries. So I think there is a lot in that. But I do come back to this idea that I don't think that public opinion vulnerability was by itself fatal. And if you're going to throw together an explanation, I think you need to point to two or three things, some of which Stephen did mention, but one or two of which I want to add to the list, that help explain how this inherent vulnerability became the Brexit vote of last June. Well, the one that you did refer to, and I think I would emphasise perhaps even more than you, is the state of opinion in the Conservative Party. It does strike me that the transformation of the Conservative Party from the party of Europe, the party of Macmillan and Heath, and indeed even early Thatcher, to the party of today, which is fundamentally Eurosceptic, with only a few dinosaurs like Lord Heseltine and Ken Clark remaining true to the old faith, as it were. That transformation is a fundamentally important one in explaining how we got to where we are now. And I think central to that, again, is another episode that you referred to, namely the way in which Mrs. Thatcher met her political end. I think for a lot of Tory Eurosceptics, in a sense, that is the original sin. The assassination by the men in grey suits, partly in the name of Europe, of their idol in 1990, was the unforgivable sin that has shaped a lot of their past subsequent behaviour. So I think the Conservative Party is fundamentally important in that respect. I also think there's a very interesting, and I don't claim at all to understand quite how this happened, it was a very interesting shift in the Conservative Party's sense of who its political associates and neighbours were that happens in the course of the 1990s and 2000, where the relatively fragile links with centre-right parties on the European continent, Christian Democrats and others, those links, which had never been particularly strong, those links were gradually severed, and instead the ties with the Republican Party became ever greater. Now, again, I don't understand fully what was happening there, but I think that's an important part of the story. I would, however, add, and I will end with these two final thoughts, two extra elements to the kind of short-term story, which means that this inherent vulnerability of British public opinion could ultimately be exploited. And the first of these extra two is the story of what happens to the left and the centre-left, because I think if the Conservative Party falling out of Europe is a clear part of the problem, so too is the decline of left-wing pro-Europeanism. It didn't go as far, hence the way in which the Labour Party is much more divided on the issue of Europe than the Conservative Party is now. But it was nevertheless significant. And I think here you have to point to the relatively recent past, and you have to look at, for instance, the left-wing or centre-left, the Guardian critique of, say, the politics of the Euro crisis, sort of the Germans being beastly to the poor Greeks, etc. That whole critique helped destroy the pro-Europeanism of the left that initially compensated, so if you go back to the era of Tony Blair, sort of Labour's pro-Europeanism compensated in some ways for the fact that the Conservatives had fallen out of Europe. In the early years, or in the first, sort of in the last 10 years or so, I think you've seen that centre-left pro-Europeanism also fall away, and that ultimately would lead to the 2016 referendum where there was basically no pro-Europeans. There were those who wanted to stay, but that was very different from actually believing in any form of idealistic or passionate fashion in the idea of European unity. So that I would want to throw in. And then there's also a messier, and I have difficulty pinning this down, explaining this, I have real difficulty identifying this, but there is something else that happens in the 1990s. And it happens at a kind of broad cultural level that explains why the British debate, and I think it is a kind of British internal conversation with one another in this country about where the future is, etc., switches from a fairly European focus that it had had in the 1980s to a much less European focused one. Let me for a second share with you, when I was an undergraduate in the 1980s, if you were, as I were, somebody who detested Mrs. Thatcher, you formulated a critique of Mrs. Thatcher that essentially was based on the German model. Your critique of what Britain could be, or my critique about what Britain could be, but those of my similarly minded student friends, was essentially that Britain should become rather more like Germany. And there were many people who adopted that same thing. Will Hutton's The State We're In is in many ways a monument to that kind of view of the world, although ironically, like many academic monuments to something, it was published at the very moment when I think arguably that opinion began to die. Something happens, and I think the whole sort of post-German unification crisis of the German economy, the seeming burst of the German bubble in the early 1990s had something to do with it, but something happens in that period which leads to a loss of interest in Britain of what's going on in Europe. And let me just throw two little indicators. They're straws in the wind. I'm not suggesting they're definitive proof, but I think they have to, in a short talk, they'll have to stand for the little evidence I can produce here. The first is the statistics on British use of Erasmus. I once on a board, I must have been very bored one afternoon. I don't do Excel, but I was playing with graphs on Excel and I plotted Erasmus usage statistics for the major European member states into Excel. And the graph is quite striking. The program starts in the early 1980s, and for the first 10 years or so, the British use it as much as everybody else. The French, the Germans, etc. It's basically by size of country. Some point in the mid-1990s, the British then suddenly lose interest. Now, I don't know what it was. I can't exactly explain what happens, but if you look at the British graph, it plateaus. The number of British students who decide that they want to spend some time, some part of their university career in a continental European university stops growing. Doesn't disappear, but it remains stable. Everybody else goes on growing. And so you suddenly end up with a situation where the British, who had been the biggest, sometimes the second biggest users of the scheme, suddenly find themselves overtaken by newly countries that are now joining it, like the Poles and others. And although it doesn't disappear, that's just one little straw in the wind. Another straw in the wind, I was talking to a senior British representative in Brussels the other day, who was saying at about the same time, in the mid-1990s, recruitment of really good Britons in Brussels begins to dry up. This doesn't stop, it actually paradoxically coincides with a period when a number of senior officials, including the person I was talking to, are in many ways at the heyday of their powers. And if Stephen was entirely right to point to a whole series of policy areas where the British influence in Brussels was actually quite great. But exactly this moment of seeming British power, if you looked at the sort of the entrance level, people applying, the number of high-quality Brits declined. Now, what does that show? It shows that ambitious young people joining the civil service or aspiring to a career as a civil servant are no longer thinking, oh, it might be a good idea for me to spend some or part or all of my career in Brussels. They're increasingly saying, no, that will be career suicide, I won't apply. Now, again, I have no hard evidence of this, although I'm hoping to write a book where I do begin to piece together some of. But I do think both of those things are telling about an underlying series of shifts that are perhaps important in exploring what we're trying to explain today. But I'll shut up there because I'm very conscious that we have to have half an hour for questions and I probably set them up, so thank you.
Thank you. Stephen, would you like to very briefly reply and then I'm going to open it up to the audience?
I don't want to take time away from questions. I would just Piers, on your last point, the falling off of interest in the institutions. I would say that coincides with a trend in the civil service, which was away from the central focus being on policy, towards managerialism, and therefore the fact that if you did policy work in either the UK representation or in the institutions, and then wanted to come back into the British civil service, you had gained no points that you could cash in, or rather the reverse.
Thank you. I'm going to take three questions at a time, just to make sure we have maximum opportunity to engage. So I'll call three questions, and then we'll come back to the panelists. Yes, sir, at the very back.
Hello, yeah, my name's Vijay. Wouldn't you agree that Britain's, from that stage where you could say that Britain had lost an empire and was looking for a role, that by entering into negotiations with the EU, it was a form of abdication of the British polity, a lack of confidence. And it was a good way of absolving politicians of their responsibility to make the tough decisions that needed to be made in the 1960s and 70s. So if you look at the north of the country or outside London and the southeast, that was mainly funded by EU structural funds. The British government didn't invest because the more money they invested would be just wasted because they get less money from the EU. And why did Britain join in sort of reaffirm their commitment in 1975 as people looked at across Europe and they decided that, well, they wanted to be part of it. And now in 2016, they had a look at, sovereign debt, bank debt, all sorts of political and economic problems. They said, well, we don't want to be part of it anymore. And oh, don't forget, LSE's contribution is that UKIP was founded here.
This is a good thing.
In fact, it was one of Pierre's colleagues who founded it. Right here at the front, please.
Keith Raffin, thank you for a fascinating speech with which I totally concurred, but wasn't your historical overview dangerously Anglo-centric? British is thrown around by the English interchangeably with the word English. I think even in Dr. Ludlow managed to get British and common law in the same sentence. Of course, common law does not apply in Scotland. But isn't the issue here that we're embarked now on a road which may not just leave result in Britain leaving the EU, but in fact lead to Scotland and, after the elections last week, Northern Ireland leaving the UK? As a Scot taught Scottish history, the dates were largely like 1295, 1715, 1745. 1295, of course, was the Ald Alliance with France, and we're dinned into us at an early age that we spent Scottish history is largely about ganging up with the French against the English. And obviously last week we saw in Northern Ireland the Nationalist Republican parties, actually the two parties, gaining a one-seat majority over the two Unionist parties, not necessarily that the UUP would now support the DUP.
Thank you. And then other gentlemen over here, please come back to the panel.
Thank you. My name is Frank Jekyll from Derby University. My first question is two related questions, and that is to Stephen. I like the way you gave the historical political history of where we are, how what's happened to the UK in the UK that led us to where we are now. But in your conclusion, you did say that you hope that Theresa May and her government will be able to show some or demonstrate some kind of wisdom and skill to do the right thing. What do you think the government needs to do to make good of a bad situation that will be pleasing to the Scots, the English, the Welsh, and all the all the nations, considering nations within the United Kingdom? So that's the question. And the second part of that question is that you look more about the historical analysis of where we are. Do you not think that also it's a kind of an indication of what the cyclic nature of society, whereby Piers actually alluded to that when we talk about the liberals and the center, the left, they kind of lost the plot a little bit, they become very complacent. Then you will now have the rise of the right wing and the far right, and that is a kind of, and when this far right kind of demonstrate and have their own show, and they discover that the solution to society's problem is not good, it's not in that, when we come back again to the liberals and it's kind of how society works. I just want you to kind of comment on that, whether you think that is a kind of cyclic view of what is happening now as a kind of way of interpreting or understanding Brexit. Thank you.
Abdication of confidence. To an extent, but it was also a realization of political reality. It's very striking that although there were powerful economic arguments for joining, given the success of the economies of the six compared with the British economy, for Macmillan that was the political argument, and for the Labour government. I mean, when George Brown, the then British Foreign Secretary, made a speech to the Western European Union, which launched the British bid, the renewed British bid to join, it's all about the politics. It's about the politics of Britain's place in the world and the exercise of global influence through the European Union. And I think you can place too much emphasis on the structural funds. I mean, because one of the arguments that raged in Whitehall throughout my career was the fact that because we were a net contributor, would we be better off not having the structural funds? Now, there are all kinds of reasons why actually that money probably wouldn't have been spent in reality were it not for the structural funds, but it was certainly an issue. Keith, on your point, I plead guilty. I've nothing to say in my defence, I'm afraid. What should be done by the government? Well, for a start, be less schizophrenic. I mean, I think it is a mark of the fact that the government know that they're in real difficulties, that they can't, and also the divisions that we've talked about within the Conservative Party, the fact that there's this group of 70 MPs who are the sort of Praetorian Guard with their swords turned outwards to protect Theresa May, but also turned inwards, that the government can't actually land on a particular discourse. But at the end of the day, we have to get to a point where it seems to me where we could do, and it isn't just down to us, it's also down to our partners, but this thing could be done. It'll be acrimonious, but it could be done in a kind of acrimony that leads to a bust-up, in which case we fall off the cliff, which in economic terms is the worst possible outcome. But also,
I mean, I do think that, you know, we are one of the large European powers. At some point after this electoral cycle, assuming that, let us say, Monsieur Macron or Monsieur Fillon, unlikely, anyway, not Marine Le Pen, is the president of France, and whatever, and that it's either Merkel or Schulz in Germany, that the British prime minister should sit down, particularly with the French and German prime ministers, and actually think about what do we, the three biggest European powers, what do we do together for the security and stability of our continent, with a very dangerous world, a dangerous Russia, an American president. I'm no psychiatrist, but I believe the technical term for his condition is loopy. And that seems to me, you know, those things get lost sight of in this very, I think, sort of trivial way the thing is dealt with, not only by Boris Johnson. On the cyclical nature of society, I mean, you may be right. I don't know. I'm not qualified really, but you may well be right. It's certainly a factor. I agree.
Just a couple of brief thoughts on that. On the abdication thing, I think sort of don't underestimate the degree to which the British leaders who chose to take Britain into the European community were assuming that by so doing they would be gaining power of a new sort and they would become leaders of that process. Now, I think one of the historical, in a sense, roots of some of Britain's problems are the fact that at least at a sort of at a public level, the idea that we became leaders of the process never really worked. Actually, if you talk to people around Brussels, you will get a lot of, particularly if you talk to disgruntled French people around Brussels, they will complain endlessly about how les Anglo-Saxons were dictating policy left, right and centre and things were going in a very British way. But nevertheless, the general public perception remained that the European community, latterly European Union, was a show run by others in which the British were uncomfortable, awkward and not very influential. And that kind of public perception has been very important in the debate. But the aspiration on the part of Macmillan when he first applied, of Wilson subsequently, and of Heath as he took it in, was to sort of use the sort of, there was the famous George Brown comment to Willy Brandt, "Willy, you must get us in so we can take the lead." And that was the assumption, that the British would become leaders of the process. And that failure to do so, or at least in any case to show that they were, is certainly one of the fascinating historical aspects of the whole story. On the breakup of the UK, the only thing I'd say, and I hesitate to venture into Scottish, let alone Northern Irish politics, but it does strike me that the sort of, it's not just going to be the Brexit factor. I think the other factor that is very, very important is, in a sense, the domestic British politics of post-Brexit. And if we do end up within a situation where we have, because of the sort of implosion of the Labour Party, where we have an indefinite period of Conservative rule, at that stage I think the chances of a Scottish vote with a different outcome from the last one grow ever higher. So I don't think sort of Brexit per se is enough to tilt the balance, but the sort of domestic political aftermath might well play into that. Finally, on the kind of cyclical thing, I think one of the great issues, for I can almost see the exam questions for future history exams looking back at this period, will be, is Brexit part of a global trend towards populism and towards a sort of retreat of liberalism, or is it a uniquely British experience that can only be explained by British factors? So to just take two of them, sort of Brexit and Trump's election, but you could probably throw in other things into the mix. Is this part of a worldwide move, or is this... are they very specific factors? I don't have the answers, but the question is undoubtedly a fascinating one.
On your first point, Piers, I mean, on the eve of British succession in 1973, Ted Heath invited the High Commissioners, the ambassadors of Canada, Australia and New Zealand in London at the time, to go and have dinner with him at Chequers. And he said, look, you guys have got to realise that we are joining the European Union, and the European Union is going to be a global superpower. This is going to completely change the dynamics of international affairs. And the Canadian said, Mr. Prime Minister, I think you underestimate the extent to which American military power will actually dictate something rather different. And afterwards, Ted Heath said to Robert Armstrong, well, you know, the poor old Canadian, he doesn't understand it, does he? But actually, he did understand it pretty well. Mm-hmm.
as a Canadian, I can say we sleep always in the shadow of the great elephant to the south, so we understand these things. Let's take a few more questions. Lady at the very back, please.
Good evening, Carolina Saludas from University of Westminster. Thank you very much for the talk. I'm very interested in your view of the role of the media in sort of short-term effect of the referendums. You mentioned Rupert Murdoch, and if one looks at history as not just the facts of history, but the sort of the telling of that history and the selling of that history. So I'm very interested in your views on that. Thank you.
Yes, lady at the front. Down here, please.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Ackley from Queen Mary University. I have a question about the sort of pathway from 1975 to 2016. My question is about the extent to which you think the fact that the Leave campaign in 1975 was small, under-resourced, incoherent, largely sort of marginalized by the media, to what extent that left certain legitimate issues about Britain's relationship with Europe unresolved, at least in terms of the public debate, and whether or not that impacted the discussion that evolved over the 1980s and up to 2016.
I'm aware of the time, so I think I'll take four in this round just to get maximum in. Gentlemen, far back, right by the camera.
Thank you very much indeed for the talk and discussions. I found it very, very interesting indeed. Having lived through most of what's been talked about, I think it gives you a completely different perspective rather than through the media. My question relates to, I think we're all guilty of taking an Anglo-Saxon approach to this. How could we operate any other way? But I wondered what the European response to the Brexit vote was, and how that differs between the 27 countries, and are there factions building up, and how do you think these will play into the subsequent negotiations?
I have one more question. Gentlemen, right in the middle.
Thanks. Just to raise an unpalatable question. To what extent do you think the whole immigration issue has been vital to the Leave vote in 2016? And a technical question related to that, to what extent, if that has turned out to be an issue which UKIP and others have overused and misused, was it due to that technical decision made in 2004 not to apply a transitional period to migrants from the then new EU countries in the East? Thanks.
On the press issue, at the time of the 75 referendum, with the exception of the Express and the Morning Star, I think all the press was pro. William Rees-Mogg, then editor of the Times, was a rabid European federalist at that point. The shift, I think, is partly of, in particular, the Tory supporting press responding to Margaret Thatcher, and then of course the deal that Tony Blair did with Murdoch in advance of the 97 election to secure Murdoch switching his support from the Conservative to the Labour Party, which then meant that Murdoch had an arm-twisting leverage over policy. I worked for Tony Blair for 4 years, from 2000 to 2004. I think I had far fewer one-on-one meetings with Tony Blair, even though I worked for him, than Rupert Murdoch did. Now, this was on Tony Blair's part a very sensible decision in terms of his self-interest, but it's a measure of the power that there was. On the question of the No campaign in 75. I think those factors, small, under-resourced, the perception, which was very evident from the opinion polling at the time, that the good guys were on the side of stay and the kind of bad guys were on the side of leave. I think that was a big factor. And then the overwhelming support of the press for remaining. European response. I think I mean, I think there's a, I mean, it's a, I think on the whole there is genuine dismay, not out of sentimental attachment to Britain, but because of its impact on the European Union, both in political terms and in some cases economic terms. I think there is a difference probably between attitudes among member governments compared with the institutions in Brussels, and that's something that is another reason why Theresa May needs to get alongside the President of France and the Chancellor of Germany. But at the end of the day, especially during the next few months, the desire to show that the European Union isn't going to be seriously damaged by it, and therefore the pressure to cohere and at least in principle integrate more, is going to be pretty strong. What happens in practice is another matter. Immigration, I mean, I deliberately didn't touch on the sort of proximate reasons for the vote, but I think immigration, yeah, was massively one of them, as we know, not just for itself, but I think for its sort of totemic significance for people, particularly people of my generation, as it were, who voted to leave, who kind of saw it as symbolic of all the changes in society that have happened over the last 50 years. You know, I was Tony Blair's advisor at the time that the decision was taken not to have a transitional period for the countries of Eastern and Central Europe when they joined. And research was done at the time which mistakenly suggested that the impact wouldn't be very big, and we were to some extent influenced by the fact that in 1986, when there were big fears of a large Portuguese and Spanish kind of invasion, that hadn't happened. You know, looking back, I mean, it would have been probably wise to have done what other member states did. And had a transitional period. I remember talking to my opposite number in the German Chancellery at the time and saying, you know, why aren't you guys? You know, you've been the bigger supporter of enlargement as we have. And he said, because if you look at the demographics, we don't need workers from Eastern Europe till 2011, and in 2011 we'll let them in. You know, that was as simple as that. And we were, of course, the champions of enlargement, and we wanted to demonstrate it, and we did not foresee what the actual impact would be.
Again, just very sorry, I'm wary of answering all questions twice, but on the role of the media, yes, I think it's fundamentally important, and if you want, it's probably the single biggest factor in explaining the two different referendum campaigns. But it's also, I think, it also helps build up an image, a relatively negative image in the whole period in between. Sort of, I was told a fascinating experience, a fascinating story by Chris Patton, saying that when he was a European Commissioner, Romano Prodi, when he first became Commission President, announced, somewhat to the horror of Kinnock and Patton, who were the two British commissioners, that he wanted to go and talk to the editor of the Daily Mail and convince him that he was a positive figure, etc. And so he made an appointment with Paul Dacre, introduced himself, etc., spent 10 minutes outlining his vision, only to be interrupted by Paul Dacre, who apparently said, look, Mr. President, I think you need to understand that the Daily Mail employs two stringers in Brussels whose only job is to find negative stories about the EU. We're not interested in your vision. End of conversation. And so if you've got a press like that, it does explain quite a lot. But it's a topic that we could talk about for hours. On the underfunded issue, I think it's very important in explaining 75. I think the idea that things were kind of not worked through in 75, which made it a temporary outcome, that I find slightly harder to buy. To be honest, I think the degree of antipathy amongst those who were hostile in 75 was such that they were, in a sense, bound to come back within a 2 or 3 years and start campaigning again against. And even if it had been an utterly level playing field and they'd had no disadvantages, which they undoubtedly did, but if it had been utterly fair, I still think they would have complained. So I don't buy that. What I do think is important is I get I get a very strong impression, although I was not an insider to either campaign in 2016, but I did get a strong impression at the time that whereas the Leave campaign had done their homework and gone back and worked out what went wrong last time round and had, in a sense, prepared their rebuttal strategy, so the whole Project Fear, etc., the Remain campaign, whether through complacency or just lack of time, had not, and they did not really go back and see what happened last time round. I was aghast to be told the other day that the Cabinet Office never went back and looked at the files of either the renegotiation or the referendum, despite the fact that as a historian that would have been the first thing that I did, but clearly there aren't any historians in government any longer.
They might have even bought a copy of my official history.
Well, indeed. But anyway, European responses, I think I think what does need to be drawn is a very clear line between, I think, the sincere disappointment at the outcome, but the realisation that as you go into the negotiations, the importance of avoiding a situation in which the British are deemed to get too good a deal and too favourable a deal and thereby encourage others to join. That is a political imperative that is very, very strong. And so I think the way in which sort of the sincerity of what was said in the various headlines that were in the front newspaper covers that were reproduced in 2016, that was sincere, but that doesn't necessarily mean that behaviour when it comes to the negotiations, whenever they start, is going to be at all, is going to be very different. I slightly disagree with Stephen with your emphasis about the sort of, there certainly are variations of opinion, but it does strike me that actually, in a way, this long hiatus during which the British have, in a sense, tried to get their act together has permitted quite a lot of degree of coordination to be happening in Brussels. And from what I hear from people I know there, a lot of effort has been made to come up with a relatively coherent position. Now, of course, that's the starting position. Once the negotiations get going, much will happen and divisions will undoubtedly appear. But I wouldn't necessarily, from a British point of view, count on the idea of sort of major disunity. Finally, on immigration, fundamental, and I think it's important because I would, if I had to identify one reason why it's important, it was an issue that gave the Leave campaign a kind of way into and a way to affect that large part of the population that, to be honest, don't care about abstract things like parliamentary sovereignty. The great problem in 75 is that the parliamentary sovereignty argument spoke very powerfully to a small group of people who are interested in politics and are appalled by the idea of parliaments being somehow... But they are a minority. They were never going to swing the vote. And the other argument that they tried in 75 to use, which was the food price one, fell flat, partly because, of course, the referendum was fought at the height of a food price crisis, a food supply crisis globally, which meant that actually European prices were not much higher than British ones at that stage. This time round, immigration gave the Leave campaign an argument that had traction amongst people for whom parliamentary sovereignty was a load of highfalutin nonsense. And I think if you're trying to explain the different outcomes, immigration is absolutely vital.
Well, I think we have reached the end of our hour. I do have one final question, and I think it can be answered fairly quickly. I'm myself a scholar of international relations, and I was very interested in your questions around Gita. Presumably Macmillan is spinning in his grave. Is that a fair estimation, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You could argue about his handling of the British economy, but he did have a view, a thought-out, coherent view of what Britain's place in the world should be. I mean, he thought about it and thought about it in a way that was very kind of interconnected. It was the end of his career when his attempt to get us in failed. And yeah, happily, I don't think people do spin in their graves, but if he could, he would.
Well, at that, please, everyone, join me in thanking Stephen and also Piers.